Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour. We've got a great show for you tonight on this February the 25th on the West Coast or in other parts of the world. And I have to say that because tonight's guest is in another part of the world. On the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone, it's now the 26th of February, as it is on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, where our guest tonight hails from. He is an entrepreneur. He's got a background in business management and economics, and even is quite an accomplished author and a philosopher. And we welcome back for the second time in the month of February my good friend Peter Kayander. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. Glad to be back.
And I should say a good morning to you.
Yes, it's early morning here. Dark, at least.
Yeah, it's still dark. Okay.
Yeah.
I've gotten a lot of email and phone calls and compliments from folks regarding your last interview, and we know a lot of the same people, and I'm hearing great things from everybody. So I just wanted to pass that on to you, outside of what I might have communicated to you already. People are really impressed with your whole approach to reality, and your book Fragments of Reality, Daily Entries of Lived Life, is really an encouraging and inspiring piece of literature, I have to say.
Thank you.
I want to encourage the listeners to go to my website, Direct Light Productions, and look at the short review that I did on the books page, and as well as have them go to your website, and you can give that address out anytime you choose tonight. I really think people should read this book just because it's so inspirational. It's especially with all the things that are going on in the world today, and we can pay attention to them or we can ignore them, but various aspects of what's going on globally, that's a real popular word. And, you know, we've always had a globe, and things have always happened globally, but they've never really been organized like the powers that be are trying to organize them right now. And your book is a breath of fresh air. It brings a sense of sanity and peace and comfort and reality, as you describe it, that I think everyone can find themselves through reading this. It's just so simple and easy to understand, and yet few have taken the time to write the things that you have written in the way in the way you have.
Yeah, someone has to write the obvious things.
Yeah. Now, the last time on the show, we talked about your background a bit and how you were inspired to write these things. And I guess, it's almost like keeping a diary, I guess, only you did it quite differently. You didn't say, well, at 9 o'clock I did this, and at 10 o'clock so-and-so said this, and then I went and ate lunch, and I had a problem with my car in the afternoon. You weren't trivial in that sense. In fact, you didn't really describe the exact details of what you were experiencing on a day-to-day basis, let's say in terms of your business or schooling or your everyday experiences, and yet one gets the feeling that what you actually experienced manifested itself in a very ethereal way, if you understand my meaning. I don't know if that's how you felt. You were writing and, let's say, keeping an ethereal diary, if you want to call it that. I don't know. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I was quite busy doing a lot of things, and I don't know why, but I started to write. And I set up a blog that was quite a new thing when it happened in 2004. So not everybody was writing blogs at the time. I wasn't the first one, I wasn't the last one, but somewhere in the middle. And, I did that for 100 days, and it was each evening I wrote something what happened during that day. Many times I knew, along the day was going on, that, okay, this is something I will write in the evening. But there were days when I did not know what I'm going to write, when I was sitting in front of my computer and was supposed to write something down. That's how the book came about. So, yes, I didn't write about those trivial things, what happens in the everyday life. You know, I'm not interested of them, and I don't think anybody else is interested either. So I just pick up or sort of distilled a few things from the events, and hopefully, it seems like that a lot of people can reflect on those and find similar things in their life. And that's, I think, why the book can be valuable for people.
Mm-hmm. I've read it a few times. It's actually quite easy to read, and yet I'm finding myself reading a chapter, if you want to call it that. I mean, you have basically one page or a couple of pages on a theme that you focus on that particular day that this writing came about. And it began to dawn on me that basically we could use the word cathart, you know, when someone vents their frustration or their anger or their displeasure with how things are going. You didn't do that per se. You came to a very simple and concise and direct, focused realization of what had occurred in that day, and you sort of critiqued society in a way, or maybe you were just critiquing yourself or your perceptions, your observations. Maybe even critiquing is not the right word, if you understand what I'm saying. But you put down your thoughts, and I read your thoughts, and I say to myself, that makes a lot of sense. This is something that I know to be true. And you're reminding me of that. And I think, within what you've written, I think I searched, especially the last time I read it earlier this week, I was searching for, let's say, the ultimate purpose underlying this. And really, you describe it in your title, Fragments of Reality. It's reality coming to you in pieces, and you sort of put it all together. And you're really seeing things the way they are, and not through all of this, not through ego, not through emotion, not through the belief system, but actual experiential knowledge, wisdom, from having correctly applied yourself to whatever you happen to have been doing at that time. And I think this is very valuable to someone that's searching for answers within themselves. Maybe they're looking outside themselves right now for the answers, and they're not finding them because they're seeing everybody else doing the same thing that they're doing, just in a different color or a different aroma or scent, or with maybe a different feeling. And yet you seem to be able to tie everything together and acknowledge universal law and the universal principles. The law of attraction and you basically debunk all the myths that are out there in a lot of things without really attacking them, just by stating these kernels of truth. And I know at the close of your last show, you gave some suggestions to the listening audience on how they could go about looking at things. I think what's most important, and I'm going to be posing this to you in a sense that you can speak to all the listeners out there who are listening now or may be listening to this as an archive as to how they can look at the rush of reality that they're exposed to right now or they're experiencing in terms of the workplace, government, family issues, societal issues. Everything seems to be ramped up and speeding in overdrive right now. And it makes a lot of people fearful. We talked about that. And it makes a lot of people very apprehensive. Yet reading this brings a sense of peace and it's, one feels, well, everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to work out. So I can just simply say read Peter's book, but I think it's important for you to express what the book means to you and how you feel it can help people. Because it's not just a book to read. It's actually a manual for life, in a sense.
Yeah, that's a good description. And typically I say that it's a workbook. So if you do the work, it will help you. So it's very simple to read the book, you know. It's not many pages, and they are rather short, all the articles or the chapters. But there's a lot of stuff in it. It's simple language, but they're quite profound, the themes and the ideas. So, and since they have been put together so that you could reflect them yourself and find the similar things in your life, the book starts to have a dialogue with you if you start to do similar things in your life. So like you said, I try to look the world in a objective way. And it means that I'm not putting my opinions or my emotions or any of these things. I just try to see the things how they really are there. And this helps in your life. If you can observe better what's happening, you are not seeing what you expect to see, but you see what is really out there. This helps you to do your business better. This helps to improve your relationship with people, and this helps with your own expectations and with your own life and how what you get out of it. And like you said, I think every generation is saying that the world is speeding up. Everything is happening faster and faster. Look 100 years back and people are saying the same thing about the modern times. Well, the modern times nowadays, we are saying that, you know, all the communications and stuff are making things more hectic, but I don't know. It's always how we perceive the world and how we are feeling inside. And that's typically the thing. If you're looking outside and only doing those things what other people are expecting you to do, you can feel a bit hollow inside. And hopefully this book will help you to look inside and also observe the external world in a new way, which is more like a child is looking at the world. Like everything is new and it's wonderful and nothing is taken as a granted. And there's a lot of new miracles happening and wonderful things around there, but we just don't see them because we think we know what is out there, and therefore we don't really see what is in there.
Mm-hmm. Well said. I sense that that inspiration, one could say, came from your higher self, or you just tapped in, you know, to the center of the universe and just got the knowledge, you know, you saw it and you just put it down without the thought process per se, more like you were just there, if you understand my meaning. Thinking, we're taught how to think. So, you know, if we're using the methods of how we think, we're going to get the results that teaching process is intended for us to have. But you escape that. Do you feel like you were being inspired from some other plane, or was it just your awakening to that reality and valuing that more than, let's say, the protocols, you know, behind the standard education and the influence of religion or society in general?
Well, my mind has been quiet almost all the time in my life, and it means that there's no constant rambling going on in my mind. So the monkey mind is what we spoke about last time, is silent. So it helps, you know, if you don't have to focus on two things at once, what's happening inside your mind and what is happening in the, so to speak, external world. And I think that makes it more clear and maybe helped me to get a better perspective on things. But I don't know about the higher self. It was a time when maybe things get more clarified for me, and I get a bit more silence in my mind, and now it's completely silent, so to speak. So yes, I think there was some processes going on at the time, and you can see it, and actually there's a lot of things between the lines, so I think it's enough said about it. But you know, yes, you're right about it, you know, there was a lot of things happening, and I tried to express those in the book, and for example, now I already moved on to other things, and the book is 4 years old, and now be more focused on society, but my mind is still quiet, and I can see still those things and talk about these things. So it's a constant process of change, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to apologize for my mind being agitated at the moment. If I quiet it, we'll have silent radio, and that might be a good thing in a sense. But everyone will be turning up their volumes, you know, waiting for the next word that will never come. So I have to be sort of thinking and trying to get some answers, you know, that some of the listeners, answers to the questions the listeners posed since your last visit. Okay, you mentioned the monkey mind. And you know, we know of the 100th monkey principle, you know, that, you know, it's sort of like monkey see, monkey do, and then all of a sudden, one monkey comes up with a different way of doing things, and then all the other monkeys follow that way, and so there's progress. But you're inviting the reader of your book to silence themselves, go into the quiet of the inner recesses of their being, which is really, as far as I feel, and you may totally agree, that it's more in the heart than in the mind. The mind is where all of the monkey business is going on right now, and so you're suggesting that one become quiet and just listen and allow things to come that way. And I've done that for a number of years. My work currently doesn't allow me to do that as much because I'm researching, I'm following facts, I'm trying to reveal the truth as best I know how, and still stay in that space that you're describing. And one of the things that people confront is fear. You know, they're afraid to change, and yet they desire to change. They say, well, I want things to be better, or we want things to be better, or why can't they be better? And the monkey mind will, you know, you have 99 monkeys blaming the way they do something on each other. And finally, one of the monkeys realizes, I'm going to just try it this way, and does it a different way. And then the rest follow. And so now you have a new monkey mind, maybe a little more enlightened monkey mind. You know, this process of analyzing isn't intended to paralyze, as Krishnamurti would say. You know, analysis causes paralysis. You can just keep over-analyzing something and be spinning your wheel, like the exercise wheel in the hamster cage. We're speaking about change, but where we each take our own responsibility. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah, actually, coming back a bit and clarifying the thinking mind and the thought process, you can always be in the silence, and this is quite difficult to describe, but the idea is that You can, what I mean by the silence of the mind is not that, you know, you cannot think, like when you calculating 1 + 1 = 2. That's yeah. thinking.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and you can process the facts, but while you're doing 1 + 1, you are within the process and you're doing it then. But after the process stops, you say 2, then the silence kicks in. And before you do another calculus, there's nothing between. And this is basically the same thing when people are composing or doing innovative things. When they are, you know, rambling about something, that's not when the, you know, great new ideas are coming. It's when they are sitting under a tree and the apple fell, you know, on their head. Or, you know, it's something, you know, beyond extraordinary happens, which is not coming from their thinking mind. So the creative inspiration and these things are truly not coming from your existing knowledge base, because otherwise it would not be new mm-hmm. for you. So if you can tap into this silence and constantly be surrounded by this silence, it means that you pretty much inspired all the time. So you can create your life in a new manner all the time. And you are not bound by those old paradigms and patterns and models and behavioral things you've been learning, you know, from your culture, society, from your childhood and so on. So this is the silence what I'm talking about. So you can be absolutely swamped with a lot of things. You can do tons of things and be as busy as you like and still be within this silence. And it only improves and helps you to do those things. It mm-hmm. doesn't take anything away. So that's a clarification.
Yeah, yeah. I understand that, too. I mean, I've experienced that. And really, that silence that you're talking, that moment in between the thoughts, becomes more profound when you extend, let's say, the duration of that silence. At first, for someone, it may come in a split second, and then it goes away, and the next thought appears. And we're talking about, I think maybe you'll agree with this, maybe you'll disagree. I think one progresses, in a sense, to the facilitation of being in that state through practice. In other words, it would be like, okay, you have a term paper to do for school. Okay, so you're doing some research. Is that the best time for you to attempt to begin being silent? Well, it's not impossible, but the average person is going to have these thoughts flying through their head, and they're organizing things, and they're looking for things, and they find it, and they're feeling excited about finding it or frustrated about not finding it. And so the silence is not there in that sense. And yet, if they sat down and took a couple of minutes, And for some that might be to meditate and do some deep breathing exercises and just allow themselves to just quiet the thoughts. And then from that knowingness or that experience of finding that silence, and it might not happen the first attempt. They might have to practice it for days or weeks, but then they find that moment and realize what it feels like and what it's like, and then they can come back to that now once they've discovered it. It's like finding that apple tree. If you're hungry and you're out someplace in nature and there's an apple tree standing there and it doesn't belong to anyone specifically, I suppose you could take an apple and eat it. If you're expecting to find an apple tree, you might become very frustrated in not finding one. So it's sort of when you find it, you know it's there, and you can come back to it. Worst comes to worst. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but what I'm trying to say is that do you suggest that someone, aside from reading your book, maybe using these ideas in your book as a kernel for meditation, or, you know, just quiet thought?
Absolutely. The book is pretty much about finding your own way to these things. And Well, meditation have a lot of meanings, and I suppose almost everyone has their own meaning for it. But but what I mean by it is, well, the one method I can recommend is the Vipassana meditation, which is pretty much you quiet your mind and just focus on being and focus on the concentration of focusing on the non-thoughts or the breathing. And this you can extend, maybe do once or twice a day, early morning, the first thing in the morning or the last thing in the evening before you go to bed and sleep, and then before you wake up, so after you wake up. So these two points you can then extend during the day by just reflecting or remembering how to do those things. And yes, I think practice makes you a master. And once you find that peaceful, relaxed state of mind or state of being, it's ever easier to come back to it and extend it and make it sort of a constant practice. And that's pretty much what it's about, being in the silence all the time. So you are relaxed and you are in a creative mode all the time. It doesn't really matter what's happening outside of yourself, whether in a traffic jam or you're in a meeting or someone is yelling at you or whatever's happening. You just, you know, observe those things, and you're not getting involved with those things. You're not attached to those things. You can, for example, people say that, you know, I'm emotional, I'm angry, or those things. They say, I am angry. But in this state of mind, you can just observe yourself that I'm getting a sensation of getting angry. So you are not sort of immersed yourself with those emotions. You feel those coming and then you see those going, but you don't cling to those and you are not getting overwhelmed by those issues and emotions and things happening in your life. And this balances and makes your life more relaxed, and you chill out better. And, you know, it's more cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, too. I think the fear factor that a lot of people has comes from the conditioning that they get through the media. For instance, you're describing the anger and how we react in situations, and we're conditioned. You know, the people that watch the soap operas on television or certain types of TV programs, it doesn't matter what it is. They're called programs for a reason. You know, when you have a program in a computer, it does a specific task, doesn't it?
No. And you push the button, it does something.
Yes. Okay. And so when you're watching a program, you know, we don't think about these words that are used to describe it.
But it pushes your buttons there.
Yes. It pushes your buttons or turns them off, all right? You know.
No.
And it affects your circuitry, basically. These things are well planned and well thought out, well designed. You know, I think if someone saw the first soap opera ever produced, and I don't know which one that would be, if that's The Edge of Night or, you know, the name doesn't matter. They're all alike. They all follow the same format. They have different characters, but the theme is the same. Betrayal in business, betrayal in personal relationships, betrayal in marriage, betrayal within the family, jealousy, ego, greed. All of these things that we would not choose for ourselves if we were consciously making our own choices. In other words, if we were really exercising our responsibilities, we wouldn't choose anything like that for ourselves. And yet we watch this as if somehow by watching it on TV, we're seeing it someplace else other than in our lives. In other words, it's not happening to me because I'm seeing it on TV. When in reality, the TV program is designed to cause it to happen in your life, because that causes illness and that causes failure and that causes one to become controlled or weak and at someone else's will. In other words, you're giving up your sovereignty and you're shirking your responsibility, and it causes you to be in denial. Now, if you saw the first show and then you saw the most recent one that they played today and you were old enough to have experienced both of those, you'd say it's the same theme. It's the same story, just some different people. The older ones died and passed on, and now it's their great-grandchildren who are the stars. Do you get that impression that television is or the media in general is designed to keep us in these thought forms, sort of in the matrix?
Yeah, I think these are the common themes what you can find from the history as well, earlier in the novels and theater plays, and so it's not I don't think it's any new idea or invention in that sense, just a different media. And I think part of it can be done on purpose, some of it can be also done in a way that, you know, that's what people want to hear, that's what people been programmed, or that's what people been expecting or been seeing, and now want more of it. So I think it's a complete package. It's what you've been learning from your childhood, from your education, what has been thought in the school, and all these things together build up your expectations and what do you see and what do you get accused, what do you get familiar with. So yes, it's a lot of those emotional things what are discussed and shown in TV, and typically they are the negative ones. And if you look those shows, watch those shows, I don't think you can feel happier and a better person after seeing those things. And this is the reason also that, you know, I don't bother watching too much of TV at all. I haven't owned TV for I don't know how many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty much the same thing with songs. If you listen to the lyrics of the songs as well, it's quite a lot of the same themes. It's selfishness and you know, it's about me, myself, and I, the ego things. And even most of the, I would actually dare to say that all of the love songs are the same stuff. You know, they are about selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not aware and you are not conscious what is being actually put to you, and you just take it in, it goes to your subconscious mind, and it starts to affect you. And, a lot of people know that if they watch a movie in the evening, and it's a horror movie or whatever, you know, it affects their dream. And this is the same thing when we're listening to radio and we're watching these shows. They are subconsciously just doing something to our lives, and it may not have an effect immediately, but after a while, you know, those things start to happen.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that it makes a lot of people. I don't watch the soap operas. I've you know, years ago I looked at a few minutes or two, and I hear people talking about them, and it's gossip. In other words, it focuses one's attention on what is not important. It's not what one would automatically choose for their lot in life, and yet so many people are entrapped in it and unaware that they're entrapped. And yet at the same time, they complain about their circumstances, whether it's in their relationships or their job. Use the word creativity, because everyone loves an activity where they can be creative. It doesn't matter if it's music or art or making something, you know, making some furniture or growing a garden or growing flowers and plants or raising animals. Something where they feel they're creating life, or they're supporting life, sustaining life in a way, touches them in a more meaningful way than many of the other things they experience at work or on the way to work or on the way home from work, or just in the everyday survival activities like going out to buy food. And you get the meaning, I think, you know, that we the things that we consider important are usually the most trivial aspects of our lives, aren't they?
Yeah, and I don't think they are trivial. It's just that, you know, our, somehow we feel that when things are complicated and you know, there's something, you know, fascinating about them, that then they are important. But if you look, you know, I think it was Janet Jackson who, in one of her songs, she mentioned that all the best things in life are free. Maybe it's not her quote, but that's just at least in one of her songs. So this is pretty much how it is. You know, just wake up in the morning and go outside and listen to the birds singing and the sun is coming up and there's a fresh breath of air. And, you know, those things are free. They don't, you know, cost a thing. You know, someone is smiling at you. You can compliment someone and you can just enjoy your breakfast and, you know, all these things, you know, these little things, they're not trivial things, they're called life, as I would say, and the complex things, if there's something complex, it's unnatural.
Mm-hmm. Well,
mind which makes the, you know, the complexity, and it means that it hasn't grasped something yet. It's too complex for the mind. When it's simple, you know, all the great things are simple. When you can simplify it, then you really understand something.
Yeah. Governments often orchestrate elections on the basis of free health care. And yet, that's sort of an oxymoron, because to use Janet Jackson's definition of the best things in life are free, that doesn't mean that the health care that would be administered is the best method of applying health care, because that would be what you just described in going out into nature and doing what is natural and not what is synthetic. So I just bring that up, that we have these oxymorons and they focus our attention on those things that really are not natural, but they use the words, they couch the words in flowery language that makes it acceptable. You know, you say the right to life, and yet you have the right to destroy life, only they couch it under a different term. So we have all these phrases and this language that we're using that really causes a lot of confusion, doesn't it? In one's ability to reason and sense reality.
Yeah, words tell us lies, all of them. At best, they are only half truths, and that's why the reason is that there's two parties for the words: the one who's sending those out and the one who's receiving them, and both of them have different meanings because each and every one of the, well, both of these guys are living in their own subjective world, and they interpreting and perceiving the world differently, and they're having different knowledge and experience, and this. This shapes how they their perception of the world and the meaning for the things. And when they attaching meanings for those things they are expressing by using symbols called words, and they're sending them out, then there's another person who is receiving them and having completely different set of beliefs and experience and knowledge, and he or she is just translating them with the best intentions and the knowledge of and perception of her point of view. So this makes it so complicated, and still we believe that the words are very clear, precise, and there's only one meaning or, you know, one purpose for them, and this makes a lot of mess for things, and it's easy to spin around the language and make things seem like that they're something else. What do you really mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, while you were saying that, the words, I took the S and put it in front, and it spells sword, which you use to chop someone up or stab them with, you know.
Well, the word is mightier than the sword, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and you know me, I'm always looking at words backwards, forwards, inside out, and, you know, they can be scrambled. Often the meaning of the word is somehow hidden. You know, messages are often hidden in how those words are used, whether they're patterns of speech or new uses to cause us to think a certain way. Again, we get into those those aspects of what you recommended in going into the silence and seeing things. We can react to too many things, I think, and in the wrong way, that we give up our personal power in that sense. And so I agree with you totally about this issue of words and language. And I guess even between different languages, you know, you find certain words in the English language, for example, that have derivatives in the Greek or in Latin, and yet they're not teaching us Greek and they're not teaching us Latin. Doesn't mean you can't learn it. You have to take a special course to learn that. But we have words that are influenced by French language and German language or Spanish, or sometimes words are just made up out of thin air. It's that way, I'm sure, in other languages too, don't you think?
Yeah, languages are part of the culture, and they are just the means for expressing things and getting the concepts out for what you're trying to describe and what you're trying to tell. So what I encourage people to do, and that's the same in the book, is that look beyond the words, look what's behind them. Don't focus on the word. It's like if someone is pointing something at you, don't look the finger, look at, you know, the landscape, the direction the finger is pointing. It's the same thing that those are the issues we should be focusing on. What are the real concepts? What are the real issues behind the words? And it's not so obvious many times. So the word, the sentences and the language can say something, but still the meaning can be exactly the opposite. And this is why you have to get the complete picture of things, you know. Sometimes you're seeing some person is lying, you know. So he's saying something else what his words are saying.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the life is about, seeing the reality as it is, not how it appears to be to you, but what is really out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's a difficult concept for someone who hasn't experienced a state of consciousness or a state of being where there are no words to describe it. I'm sure you've experienced that. I have. And you find yourself when you're attempting to describe what that feels like or what occurred during that moment, we don't really have thought patterns or words that describe that, do we? In the total sense.
Yeah, I think there are different ways to express things, and arts are a very good way. You know, someone is singing, and another one is performing, and the third one is painting, and putting all these things together, I think, are the ways to do those things. So it's expressing life in various of ways, and I think this is the creative process we sort of have forgotten. Mm-hmm. We are living sort of the serious and important life, and going to office and going back from the office and, you know, eating something and going to sleep. And, you know, someone called this living, but, you know, is it really living? We're just chasing a few funny papers, you know, called notes, and that's what our life is mainly about. But, you know, once again, the things which are free are the things we enjoy the most.
Mm-hmm. And while you were describing that, and I was paying attention to what you were saying, what came through was my perspective of art and my perspective of music. And this is not to belittle, let's say, the aspect of music using lyrics and someone singing. But there is a mindset that music, instrumental music, is something less than someone singing a song because of our inclination to want to hear a story. And in fact, when you're communicating something to a group of people, let's say in a political speech or in a motivational speech, if you tell a story, you get the attention of the listener because human beings like to hear stories. And so a ballad, for instance, you use the example of a love song. It tells a story, but it's always this story of heartbreak or betrayal or loss or depression. It could be happy. I don't always feel that music that's going to make me happy or song about being happy sounds like what I'm hearing. You know, so there seems to be an emphasis put on the importance of singing, as opposed to instrumental, performance. And yet, the way the universe operates, when one reaches a level of understanding and hears that silence, you can actually hear the music of the spheres or, you know, the planets, the universe. You can hear sounds that actually exist. And that yet no particular person is playing this, but it's been worked into creation that it's always there. And it's giving life to everything. It's giving, imparting the information. And it's not just the music that's doing that. The light is doing that. And light in an art sense or in an artistic sense, you would compare it to, let's say, a nature scene, mountains and streams or grass and trees and sky with maybe some clouds or light in the sky, as opposed to a picture of some cartoon character munching on a piece of chocolate. You know, you can have two types of art expressing those images, but one is a very natural and lifelike image, and the other one is totally designed to get your thought process focused in a particular direction. So that advertising picture or that song that's advertising an emotion or a feeling, both do the same thing. And yet people are very unaware of the process that's being played on them to cause them to think or react a certain way.
Yes, and you actually mentioned something very important. Songs typically have a, you know, we express and we having moments when, you know, there's a great love song and you're with someone special and just the first date or something and you always remember the song. Or there was something sad happening in your life and there was somehow background music from radio and you always, when you hear that song, you associate that song to that state of mind, that feeling. So when you hear that song, you know, not consciously, but subconsciously, you're hearing the song and you're starting to feel blue or you're feeling great. These are the things which are affecting us. So we're also attaching emotional things for the music. And if you do not recognize that this is happening to you, you can, it can be a lot, quite confusing that, you know, I was just happy a minute ago and I'm sad, or another way around. So music has a lot of influence on us, and it works on many levels. And at the moment, I pretty much enjoy not listening to anything. But you know, like I said, most of the lyrics are quite negative. And if you're truly listening to what they're saying, you know, it's quite a silly and stupid in many occasions. So I opt out not to do that, but you know, jazz and there's a lot of other great music, so you can listen without having the lyrics. So this is also like all the aspects of life. You know, they're complex and still simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, I just wanted to point that out, that what you were describing about that process and the source of it, or at least, you know, the experience of tuning into that frequency, something to that one can expect to see, to have an understanding. Now, you know, there are those out there that are maybe thinking, well, that's ridiculous. You know, I like listening to the Beatles, or I like the Rolling Stones, or this song by Bruce Springsteen really makes me feel good. no one, that's exactly what we're talking about. That it's the song making you feel good, and it's not you making you feel good. Or it's not your ability to tap into what will consistently make you feel good. Or make you consistently productive or successful or creative. And I don't necessarily mean productive like you're on an assembly line in a factory, but I mean where your activities in your life are giving you satisfaction and a sense of accomplishment, that you're experiencing your real life's purpose and not the one that's been offered you. Is that what sort of what you're saying, or?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we don't have to take music so seriously, you know. It's just a thing in our life, and it can have a lot of purpose for us. And this way, what I'm maybe trying to tell is that if you're aware of the things and the effects it can have to you, and you can use it as a tool for tuning into a good mood, or you can use it to relax, or you can just use it for entertainment purposes, or you can just use it for no purpose at all, but just for fun or whatever. So it's just that, you know, we're paying attention to what we're doing, and we're focusing, and we're choosing to do those things. So we are not allowing ourselves to just drift to those situations and have effects which we are not intending to have, because that means that you are not in control. You're not controlling your life. You're not controlling what is happening. And by control, I don't mean in a sense that like you're driving, you're controlling the car, but you're not making choices. You're not making conscious choices what's happening. Music is very fundamental and very strong and powerful medium which affects us, and this way it's good to notice this behavior.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of things in life that really direct our behavior. Some of these things are written into the law, and you know, there has to be a certain amount of order, I think, or otherwise we would have just chaos. But do you feel it's really, ultimately, really necessary to create laws if everyone was able to tune into these higher concepts? We wouldn't really require laws, would we?
Law and order are typically put together.
Yes.
You know, they're tied together. But order is a different thing than law. We are having order right now. And I would claim that we're having the order because people believe on those laws.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, there's an example in the movie, you know, The Dark Knight, if you saw the latest Batman movie. And the Joker is the maverick fellow, the random guy who he's not your typical criminal type. He's not appealed to money and, you know, power and all those things. He just wants to create chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one episode in the movie where he says that, well, this is quite a funny, I'm just paraphrasing it freely. It's quite funny that, you know, people are just behaving nicely and things are in order, but once you take out the mayor, you know, the big guy in the, and everybody's looking at, you know, the leader,
mm-hmm.
then everybody goes berserk. You know, it's complete chaos outside, you know, everybody goes just, you know, out of their mind. And I think that's what the law and order is pretty much about. We're having an idea that everything is okay, but it's just an idea, and we believe on that external thing called law or the government or the police. But if you're observing the regular life, you know, no matter where you are, in a deserted island where there's only a few people, or you pretty much go anywhere in the world, there's an order in there. You know, you don't see police, you don't see these governmental officials who are supposed to keep the order in place. It's just an illusion in a way. Regular life would be having, you know, we are in order, and it's just that people are feeling safe.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are projecting the safeness to these external bodies, institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But as well, we could say that we are creating the order all the time by our own very act and our own actions and behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I would claim that it's possible. I'm not saying that it can happen right now because it needs that people needs to become responsible and realize this, but we would not necessarily need laws. We would not necessarily need police and military and these institutions at all. We could self-govern ourselves, and there would be order, because this is the natural way of things,
mm-hmm.
in human beings as well. Of course, there's always rotten apples or those who try to test that whether other people are still trying to keep the order, and then it falls to each and every one of us as to respect and just keep that order in place, because the chaos is the unnatural thing.
Well, yeah,
that was pretty much about it. What I was trying to say.
Yeah, I know, and you probably would agree to some extent, and the listening audience would agree that those that are creating the laws are busy creating a lot of the disorder, so that they can create more laws. and it becomes a power issue, or a power struggle, or this determination to rule absolutely over everyone else, and so because it's so different from the natural process that you're encouraging people to approach, it does create chaos. In other words, it's the very people that are supposed to keep the order, or be an example of keeping the order, as they serve us as our representatives. What it's turned out to is they want us to be their servants, and so we have a dichotomy there, and as a result, we have some chaos, and likely there will be more, and yet people are still searching for inner peace, and to be in a state of love with everything. I mean, how can you love nature and not love mankind? Or vice versa. The two go hand in hand. Man exists and subsists because of nature. And yet we're at a point now where we're destroying both, or we're allowing it to be destroyed. And that's where our responsibility comes in, our personal responsibility. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Law, what is, when someone mentions law, we immediately related it to the morality and ethics, but that's not the case anymore. It doesn't implicitly mean that the law is moral and it's ethical.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was the idea behind it sometimes, you know, in the past, you know, thousands of years ago, but that's not the case anymore. The morality is not in there. The law is not the justice. And
yes.
If law is justice, and there's an excellent essay from Frédéric Bastiat, a French economist, he actually wrote it in the 1850, and it's exactly like it is today. I recommend everyone to read it. You can find it free of charge, you know, in the internet. It's in public domain. It's in English and it's French. And he says that if law is justice, and law should be about justice, and then the law can only be a negative term, meaning that it only says what you cannot do, and it cannot provide you anything more. And nowadays we want from the law something more than just to be justice. And if law is only justice, it means that, you know, it says that, you know, you respect each and everyone's, you know, freedom, and you are not allowed to infringe anyone else's similar rights. And this is the meaning of law, which is justice and order. But if you start to attach to the law meanings it doesn't naturally have, and it cannot have without breaking the order itself, the justice, then it's not law anymore. It's not an order anymore. It's law still, but it's not the order anymore. So what we're having nowadays is not anything pure anymore. We want to have more, but unfortunately the law cannot give it to us, because they are only us, the people. So we can only do those things to ourselves. The institution or the concept or the word law cannot provide us anything what we can do ourselves. It's like the government is promising jobs to us. Mm-hmm. This is once again in the past the arts. He has another essay called "What is Seen and What is Not Seen," and it's exactly like from you know today's world, and he's talking about that you know government is creating work. Napoleon was doing that, and he actually is having a Napoleon as an example there, saying that Napoleon thought that he was doing a great job there. He was paying people to dig ditches and then fill them up. So it doesn't really matter what they're doing, but as long as they're doing work. And it's the same thing here that, you know, we're doing the silly things and we believe that we can create jobs, but, you know, only thing government can do is take money from someone and give it to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But why do that? It doesn't create any jobs. It just shifts the jobs from one place to another. It might be easy if you take $1 from everyone and then you have $300 million and you just pull it to one place and build a huge, whatever, military base or do something similar. It looks like you're doing a lot. But those $300 million could be allocated by each and every individual to the purposes they feel are important, and this way they also create jobs. So we're using the law as the expression goes, divide and conquer.
Mm-hmm.
So we're splitting up the us, the people, by using these instruments. And this is the origin of the chaos. This is why things are so messed up in our world. We want something what is not possible to get without creating chaos, without breaking the rules, and without making violence against each other and the nature. So we're not responsible. We're not adults, so to speak.
Well, imagine if each one of us, every person on the planet, listened to the silence, you know, sat down at the same time of day and became quiet and allowed the laws of the universe to speak to us, those silent laws that really are making a lot of noise. We just don't hear it because we're making more noise, in a sense, if you understand my meaning. What do you think would happen if we all did that at the same time?
Well, it would change. And it would change not because anything great, but it would change because we would change. The people would change. What would you do if you would be in harmony? What would you do if you were in a good mood? You would be happy. You would be, you know, tranquil and you would take life a bit more easier.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we mentioned about the TV shows, you know, people having emotional issues, they're having all those trouble and they're doing those things because they are feeling bad. They're feeling miserable. But if you start to feel better, it would immediately also change the way you live, change the way you, how you act, behave, and what you do and why you do those things. So a lot of these crazy things we're doing nowadays could actually disappear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we constantly hear now the talk is the people that are waking up. The war on drugs is failing, and I say no, it isn't. Now that sounds insane, but we have war, and everybody's on drugs. Now, of course, that doesn't mean everybody, but the majority of people on some sort of drug. And so they're not realizing their full potential while people are being murdered and someone's making lots of money.
And the thing is, once again here, that, okay, first of all, when people are in drugs, they are escaping something. You're not facing something. And I'm not saying painkillers and stuff. You know, sometimes you need those things. But, you know, if you're just taking for just to not handle your issues and get a grip of your life. The another thing is that, what is war on drugs or war on anything, you know? Making something illegal doesn't make it go away. So when you, I'm going back to the law once again.
Mm-hmm.
If the law tries to be something it cannot provide, we want to by making something illegal, we want once again to just make it to disappear. But it doesn't happen that way. So when the government wants to get rid of the drugs, and, well, isn't the, actually the medicines, the blue pills and the stuff also drugs? So, you know, we should get those away as well to be consistent with the word. But no, not sticking to that one. Just there. The thing is that when you're making something illegal, you actually create, once again, destruction and chaos. And only way you can get rid of the drugs truly is that you change the people.
Mm-hmm.
And why should we actually change the people? Who is to say who is to do what? There's no one, you know, we are adults. So we should be responsible our own lives. If we want to take drugs, we take drugs. But, you know, we should not force anyone else to take drugs. So by making something illegal, it means that, you know, things are getting more expensive for those who will take them anyway. No matter whether they're legal or illegal, they will take them anyway. It's the same with alcohol and a lot of other things. If we would be consistent, alcohol would be banned as well, because it's a drug as well.
Mm-hmm.
But what would happen if we just ban alcohol, well, obviously we know what would happen, you know, look just in the history, 100 years back, a bit more than 100 years, people would still distill alcohol and drink it. It would be just, you know, hard tea or whatever, and, you know, in the past. So you cannot make the society moral by just, you know, imposing some laws and orders,
yeah,
regulations.
Well, they have that problem with drugs right now, too.
Yeah.
You know.
So pretty much, you know, you can fight as much as you like, but it doesn't make the problem go away. It actually becomes bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have another saying in education here in the States. This has been popular for a number of years. No child left behind, but they don't say what child, and they don't say behind what.
No.
So these sayings don't really mean anything. They only mean what they say they mean, or what people are led to believe they mean. And they're never what they claim even to be. They're just excuses to keep people's attention focused on an issue, or like you said, and very astutely, that it's divide and conquer.
Yeah, and that's the only thing the government can do. It can give privileges to someone and take from someone else.
Yeah.
It splits apart. It doesn't harmonize. It doesn't unite. It splits apart the society.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing it actually does. If it goes beyond that law is order idea,
yeah,
that the law is justice.
Now, with your background in business you know, let's say in marketing or in promotions or technology, and you really have a diverse background beyond having written Fragments of Reality. But you took the time, even with that background, to really bring an important message forward. And now we're hearing things here in the States. We're hearing about certain bank failures all over the place. And of course, we've been talking about that for some time. And it's all based on the illusion of what money is and people's misunderstanding or their total lack of knowledge about the meaning of money or wealth or success or any of those things. But we're hearing the same things are happening, in Europe. Iceland, for instance, had a complete banking collapse. What are you hearing in a spiritual sense from the people that you're in contact with in Europe about what is going on? I think our listening audience here in the United States would be very interested in their perceptions and how they're dealing with it.
Yeah, I think the situation is the same everywhere. Businesses are in trouble, the demand is dropping, and they have to lay off people, and the banks are in worse shape than they being admitting to themselves and to the public. And people are starting to realize that this is not going away, it's getting worse. And the government is not helping. they try to put some stimulus packages together, but it's a joke once again. They cannot control what is happening because they cause it to happen, and now they just have to take the medicine and sit tight and they pretend to do something, but they are not in control. So I think this is global thing now, and this is global because it's been made to be global. It's been this what happens when you have a monopoly in money and you take something away which would have worked if it would have allowed to work, and this is the banking cartels' doings, and now we just have to sit tight and hope the governments are not doing too much to get away with it. But what is good about the, well, once again, this is funny. When things are great and businesses are booming and everybody is happy, you know, it's quite easy to levitate in the hot air. Everybody can do that. But when the hot air drops off, you know, then the true masters are coming out who can levitate. And this is the same with businesses, you know. It's very easy to have a business when there's a boom time, artificial booms as they are. But when things are getting tough and rough, like they are doing now, it means that those companies who are solid and they are having real business and they are satisfying their customers. Now we are actually punishing all those. Well, it's same with the people who are being paying their mortgages, you know, diligently and, you know, saving every penny and not miss a payment. And we are not rewarding those people. We are punishing those people because we are encouraging now with the bailouts and these stimulus packages all the reckless behavior in the world, and we encouraging and we will make sure that it will happen in the future as well.
Yeah,
and that's quite a funny.
yeah. Now I agree with you, and I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to, pose, or let's say, bring forth my observations as to the positive aspect of what you just described, because it looks very dreary and it creates a lot of fear. But if we realize all of this is based on illusion. You know, the banking system and the money system, usury system, fiat banking and usury credit, and all the derivatives and the hedge funds, the things that are duplicitous aspects of the foundational principle of fiat banking. It's actually a blessing in disguise, isn't it? In other words, people who are realizing that the illusion itself is becoming clear that
yes
that
yeah.
that opens the opportunity for us to create something new, doesn't it?
Indeed, and once again we are trying to create something unnatural. Everything is fine as long as everything is going up, but why was everything going up? It was mainly due to inflation, the real inflation, which is the expansion of the monetary supply. So it's not a consumer index like the government is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And we're only measuring these nominal values, not the real values of things. So if you're expanding something, you know, GDP goes up and so on and so forth, but real values actually can go down. And we don't think that there's anything unnatural about it, that, you know, things are only going upwards all the time, you know, with exponential growth. You know, if anyone understands anything about mathematics, exponential growth is not natural, you know, in our state of being and in our world. So it cannot last. And still, we want to have this state of, you know, status quo going on all the time. And when things are starting to go another way, it is natural, you know. When sun goes up, it goes down as well. And then when it rains, you know, it stops rains at one point in time. So there's a cyclical pattern of things. And this is the same with companies, for example. You know, there are good companies and bad companies. Why we are not bailing out each and every, you know, failed business in the world? Why we are only picking up a few of those? So if bank is failing or, you know, some other business is failing, okay, let it go, you know. It doesn't mean that, you know, the underlying assets which are in the banks, you know, the deposits and the loans, they're not going anywhere. They're not going away. It's the same thing when the boom happens. there's a more loans available. You know, government is just artificially lowering the interest rates, so there's banks are giving up more loans, and this is the nature of the fractional reserve banking, and it creates a, you know, the credit boom. But making that loans available, making this money available, doesn't bring at all, none, de nada, wealth to the society. It doesn't bring up any new goods or services into the world. That doesn't happen. It's the same thing will happen when the credit crunch happens. There's no more loans available. It doesn't destroy any of those things either. No property, no cars, nothing disappears when the credit goes up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something which is not understood either, you know. So it's not the end of the world when the loans are going down. It just means that there's a reallocation of those assets from old owners to new owners, those who can take better care of them, those things. So this is how things happen, has always happened. You know, someone builds something and it doesn't work anymore, and someone else, you know, carries on from there. And now we're just having it in a monumental scale, and you know, this is not natural, and this is artificially created by man,
mm-hmm.
and it is created by the monopolistic system. So it's quite a horrendous what is happening, and it's creating a lot of distress to the people. But it's not the end of the world.
Yeah,
and. If we continue to do this, and we are not allowing these losses to happen, we only have allow the profits to happen, there's something fundamentally wrong with us.
Mm-hmm. That's why I brought this up, because there is a responsibility all the way across the board. It's always put on the little people, the people that have less in terms of that system. You know, that doesn't mean that they're less human being, or their value, their worth is any less in a universal sense. It's our perception of it, you see, because they use these words like hope or security or sacrifice is another word. You know, these are, to me, these are myths. They're more of the same illusion, or they're colors added to the existing illusion to further mask what's beginning to reveal itself. And I think people are realizing, here in the States, they're realizing what is going on in ever increasing numbers. And, of course, the powers that be don't like that, because they have invested so much money, so much effort into hiding these things from us. You see, all these methods that we've been talking about that they use to blind us or to dull our senses to keep us from realizing what is real or what is the truth, they hide it. They do everything in secret. They plan these things hundreds of years ahead, and slowly, little by little, implement the next phase of their plan. And yet it's failing. It's failing them. And who do they come to? The very people to whom they direct all of this. It's insanity, isn't it?
Yeah, it appears that we have two separate set of rules, mm-hmm. in the society, and that's not true either. This is the state in a lot of the sciences nowadays. Well, physics, for example, how quantum mechanics and the Einsteins, you know, the Newtonian world, which doesn't fit so too nicely together. It's the same thing in the mainstream economics, not in the Austrian economics, but mainstream economics, that there's a micro and micro economics, and they don't talk to each other, and it doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't actually make any sense. And this is what you hear in the news, that the government is saying that spend, but on the other hand, don't spend, that, you know, don't lose your house. And why there are two separate, you know, set of rules, or why there are two separate of, you know, instructions given, it doesn't make any sense. And this is also quite insane that we are living, well, if you personally living beyond your means, that you're spending more than you can have afford, you know, you can, that's not a sustainable way of living, you know. There will be a day when you just, you know, nobody will lend you any money anymore because they see that you cannot give it back to them. And still we are living the same way, but it's somehow it's a different thing when the institution is not called an individual, it's called a municipality, or it's called city or government or the federal government or whatever.
Or a corporation. Then,
yeah, then it's allowed to, well, corporations, if they are private, you know, private things, that's okay. But, you know, if the public things, if you if something public, like meaning that we own it to ourselves, then it's okay to have a, you know, huge, massive debts, and we are not paying those back because we're owing it to ourselves. And somehow, you know, just getting more debt and debt and debt makes things okay. And this is quite a, I think it should be quite discouraging and strange that we putting on debt and we are living beyond our means. And what it means is that, you know, no responsible parent would do that to his or her children. You know, you would just, you know, live the life, you know, like never before, and then just, you know, say to your children that, you know, hey, you pick up the tab and you just clean up the mess and you know, sorry about it, you know, I don't have afford to my retirement, and I don't have afford to my pension, but, you know, I hope you will pay it because you owe it to me. And this is what we're doing in the society nowadays. We have a huge pension debts. We have a huge public debts.
Mm-hmm.
So we're living beyond our means. If we would be sensible and responsible adults, we would take the world from the previous generations and make it better for the next one, not worse.
Yeah, well, in that sense, we have succumbed to this type of control that we talked about at the top of the show, the mind control and the dependence on drugs and the dependence on someone else to do what we could do for ourselves, right?
Yeah, and there's no them, that it's us, we're doing it ourselves.
Yeah, but I'm speaking in the sense of those that depend on the government to do it, or some agency that works for the government, or some foundation that's out there to rescue those that the government won't rescue. And there's always some purpose. You know, like you said, there are two methods being worked at the same time. That means they're keeping two sets of books at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so again, we have more of the secret methods being employed, because if we knew in a mass sense what is occurring, really going on, and why it's occurring, we wouldn't stand for it, would we?
Yeah, we are not seeing clearly, and some people are taking advantage of it, and like the saying goes, that it's enough the evil to happen when the good men are not doing anything. And this is not a new phenomenon. For example, in the Plato's book called The Law, or The Laws, he mentions that he would recommend the government, once again the ruling body, to control monetary affairs. And the only reason to do that, why Plato said that, was that he wanted that the people would be more dependent, reliant on the government. So in other words, take away their freedom and their self-reliance. And this has been happening on for hundreds of years. And now we see the results of it. So it's, for us, it's more like a subconscious thing already, that we cannot live without the government. Almost all the people are, if not directly in the payroll, they're getting some kind of subsidies or something out of the government, which is fundamental healthcare or something else. And it is so omnipotent nowadays that we cannot live without it. And still, it's just a funny concept. It's just a concept, nothing else. It's just an idea. It's still us here, the people. And we're doing those things. We could do it without government. It's funny that, you know, I have $5 or euros in my right pocket, and then I give it to Don for a while, and he takes a commission out of it, and he's a bit inefficient what he's doing. So, see, he's giving me back 2.5, and I'm very happy about it. You know, I'm getting something for free. Mm-hmm. This is how we're working. It's just you know, it's silly. You know, I have a 5 in my pocket, and then someone is living out of that one and doing something and handing it out to someone who, you know, in a way and in a whim, and I'm not in control anymore, and it's not very sensible way of living. But you know, at least so far we've been quite happy to live with it because everybody is complying.
Mm-hmm. In our closing moments here, Peter, there's so much that I'd like to talk about that's within the book, and yet I felt, you know, from my perspective, and I hope you feel the same way, that what we've talked about tonight kind of addresses many of the issues that you cover in the book.
Absolutely.
I found myself, as I got near the end of the book, I don't mean the last couple of pages, but, you know, you seem to have really hit home runs on every topic that you discuss. I was wondering if there was one particular chapter, we'll call it, or one particular essay that you would like to share from your words, from your perspective, because it's very inspirational what you wrote. Everything becomes crystal clear as to what we must do to take responsibility in our lives, and if we started doing these things, I know that things would change. They could change overnight, literally. I don't know if you feel that esteemed about your work, but it's a general feeling that keeps reoccurring in my thoughts when I'm reading your work.
Yeah, I structured the book in a way that it starts from the simple things, and it starts to build up, and in a way distills, and that's why the final chapter is called Qualities, and the one before that is Experience. So there's actually a red line going through. The table of contents say that, you know, the first chapter is the belief system, and the next one is life and death. Then we go to the mind, and how we control the mind, called meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're having meditation, then you can have those short silence, you know, periods of silence, and this means that you can get inspiration, and that's the reason the next chapter is called Short Insights.
Yeah,
and when you're having those short insights, you can go to start to observe the world around you, and that's why the next chapter is called Reality and Ego. So there's a reality, but there's an ego, and they are in a play between each other and together.
Yes.
And when you're observing this reality and ego, you also start to see separation. You are separated from the world, and in a way, you are also within your mind. You are separated, and after that, the next one, like I already mentioned, is the experience, and then comes the qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, these qualities are happiness, forgiveness, humbleness, patience, and harmony. And this is the sort of the flow, if you're doing the work, what should come out of you. You're having these qualities.
Thank you. Oh, no. Just making a little joke out of it. but that's the sense I get, you know, from the book. And I was wondering if there's not one, you know, whether it's from the chapter on experience or qualities, what would you leave as a parting message until your next appearance on Evident Footprints as inspirational?
Okay, so you want me to read something, or you want me to tell something? Or
well, it's up to you. You're quite good at speaking the words. I don't necessarily feel that you have to read something. I'm quite capable of reading it too, but no, okay. it's your choice. I just rather than tell you what to say, I think, you know, after putting you through these hoops that I just did, that I would give you the opportunity to express something, you know, from the heart, what you would share with the listening audience, with my recommendation that, of course, they seriously get your book and read it.
Okay. Well, I'm staring at the book at the moment and looking what's in there. As a matter of fact, I translated it to the Finnish, so there's coming a Finnish edition of the book later on this year.
Oh, wow.
So I came back to my book and read my old texts. Felt like, you know, chewing an old gum, you know, without any taste anymore, but, you know. Maybe it's for everyone for their own writings. Well, there's a poem called Happiness, and I think happiness is something, you know, we all looking after and we enjoy it. And it starts by saying that happiness is a moment of joy, a smile or a kind word from a stranger. Unexpected and spontaneous, innocent, beauty of the vision, perfectness of the glance, the vulnerability of the inevitable, it all happens right here and right now. And I think that's what happiness is. It's not something external, it's not something, it's not any peak experience either that you have to get a boost, you have to get something to get it back. It's not like the Rolling Stones said, you can't get any satisfaction, so you have to go back to it and replicate it somehow in your circumstances. Happiness is about that silence. Happiness is about the moment, the freedom of the moment, the relaxation and the spontaneity of the things. So when you're not stressed, when you don't have to do anything, you flow, you're in a good mood. That's what is happiness is about. And maybe another word for it is content.
Mm-hmm.
Because happiness might be quite attached to the emotions, so we have a more, you know, it may have another meaning for many. So content, when you're content, tranquil, you're just satisfied. You're satisfied. You're always satisfied, and it doesn't mean what's happening. You might have some distress in your life, in your health or things, but overall you're satisfied. And this, I think, boils down to the freedom and independence, self-reliance.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be my message today: be happy, smile,
yeah,
experience the moment,
yeah,
feel.
I agree with you, and I would say that happiness is a state of being at one with all of creation.
And yourself.
And of course, yourself too. We're part of creation, are we not?
We are.
We are co-creators, and we have been created, so I would say that qualifies us.
Yeah, it's all us. And what is mine and what is reality, you know, that's something, you know, we are not going to do today, but, you know, I would say it's all illusion, it's all in your mind.
Yeah, and happiness would be the most natural state of being, and that would lead us effortlessly into creating.
Yeah, we don't have to get it because we have it, it's
yeah.
always us, but it's like the order thing. You don't have to create order. You only have to take away the disorder and the order will appear. Same thing with happiness. You know, you're always happy if you just choose to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you find it within yourself.
Well,
it means that you get away with your distress and you're relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm happy that you were on the show tonight. And I hope the listening audience is happy. And I'm not even going to say I'm unhappy that the show is ended, because that leaves us free to create.
So you say you're very content at this solo.
Je suis très content, monsieur. I'm very happy. But I'm also happy in knowing that if I invite you to another show, you will accept and come back and share some new insights with us. Can we count on that?
Yeah, that's good news.
And so hopefully that will make you happy and stay happy for that next moment. And I will forward any email or messages that come forth. And I want to encourage people to go to your website. Would you give out those web addresses?
Yeah, that's a promise we have to keep. You, or at least you promised to me that I can give the URL out. So maybe now it's time.
Yeah.
That you do of those for the book, you can go and actually you can read the book free of charge in the website. It's the address is fragmentsofreality.com. Fragmentsofreality.com. And then I also have a personal website and it's my name, first name, last name. So peterkajander.com. PeterKajander.com. And from there you can find, well, you can find the book as well there, but you can also find my later writings, which are more related to the society and the things we've been discussing here today.
Well, it was fascinating, and I want to wish you a wonderful rest of the month of February. And we're going to pray and visualize peace in the world and sanity and personal responsibility and creativity and success. All the things that I know people will find if they read this book. I really mean that. So I want to thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Those things sound great, and I suggest we start to do those ourselves first. And
yes.
Be a good practical example for others. So thank you, Don. It's been a pleasure being here today.
Well, I look forward to your next interview. You run into anyone I know, tell them I said hello. Okay.
Absolutely.
You're much closer to them. So thank you, Peter. And we're going to say goodnight also to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Peter Kajander. And please visit his website, fragmentsofreality.com, and get a look at this book. You really want to have the book so you can take it places that you can't take your computer. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, thank you for your continued prayers for my father's recovery. As well as for tuning in tonight, I wish everyone a night or a day filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night or a good day. Bye now.